This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Axis Mundi.
In 2012, several members of the performance art group Pussy Riot did something so outrageous, so provocative, that it garnered worldwide attention and got two members sent to a penal colony. They offered what they called a punk prayer in the inner sanctum of the Cathedral of Christ the Savior in Moscow during morning prayers. In the music video, which you can easily find online, you'll see it. Four women clad in balaclavas that cover their faces and dresses, standing in the cathedral's altar, a place women generally are not allowed in Orthodox Christianity. They're jumping and punching the air as they offer their revolutionary song, opening with the words, "Virgin Mary, Mother of God, chase Putin out." The song offered a pointed and extended attack on the Russian Orthodox Church and its leader, Patriarch Kirill, for the church and its leadership's collusion with Putin in driving repression. They critiqued Russian laws targeting the LGBT community and the anti-feminist positions of both church and state. Since hundreds of thousands of street demonstrations aren't having an impact, we will ask the Mother of God to intervene, explained one of the members as they set toward the church that morning.
Her remark described the situation in Russia for pro-democracy activists even as far back as 2012. The traditional modes of political activism in a democratic society have proven increasingly useless. The Kremlin, seemingly impervious to the will of the people expressed on the streets, elections had become a joke. In the years to come, the repression would only grow. Political opponents poisoned, most famously anti-corruption activist and opposition leader Alexei Navalny, who died in 2024 at a Siberian penal colony. Human rights, environmental, and other civil society organizations and independent media, both domestic and foreign, have been outlawed. And so in this context, no wonder the members of Pussy Riot felt a divine intervention was necessary, an appeal to a power greater than Putin's. The time for timidity was past. They needed to go straight to the heart of it all, to call out the hypocrisy of the church, the violence of Putin's policies, not with weapons nor signed petitions, but with a sung appeal to the Mother of God herself. Mary, the one who sang her own revolutionary song, what's often called the Magnificat, 2,000 years earlier. It's a song in which Mary praised a God who casts down the mighty and sends the rich away empty. Might an appeal to her, the Mother of God, might this provocative act help save democracy?
Welcome to American Unexceptionalism. I'm Matthew Taylor.
And I'm Susie Hayward. This is the show where we ask what Americans can learn from those who have resisted religious nationalism and authoritarianism around the globe.
We interview scholars and activists about the strategies they used and the lessons they learned in their fight against oppressive religious regimes.
The United States is facing a very serious Christian nationalist threat to democracy. But we aren't alone in this fight. It's time to put our American exceptionalism behind us, to learn how to create a future for all of us. The last stop on our global tour is Russia and Ukraine, two states where the majority religion is Orthodox Christianity. The conflict between these two countries is reaching nearly 3 years in length as we record this. That war of aggression by Russia upon Ukraine, it's a global story, related to the global battle between authoritarianism and democracy. And we'll explore how that is so. and we'll explore the religious dimensions of the war.
But we also want to understand the particular ways in which Orthodox Christianity in Russia is aligned with anti-democratic leaders, especially Vladimir Putin and his policies, and the effect of the Russian Orthodox Church on the Orthodox community and the MAGA movement here in the U.S.
Like all religious communities we've explored in this series, we have to distinguish between the Orthodox Church as an institution and the vast majority of people who constitute the Orthodox community. Our focus in our conversation will primarily be on the institution of the church, particularly its top leaders. But who's to say that the members of Pussy Riot don't also represent the Russian Orthodox Church? They are members of the Orthodox community. They claim religious language, offer prayer, speak with fluency from within the tradition. Which is all to say, let's remember that these religious traditions are more than just their hierarchies and their institutions. I think that's particularly important for us in the West as we look to the Orthodox Church in the East.
Okay, we have two experts joining us today. Sarah Riccardi-Swartz from Northeastern University and Regina Elsner from the University of Munster. Let's have them introduce themselves and say a bit about how they came to study church and state in Russia and Eastern Europe. Sarah will go first.
So I am an anthropologist and scholar of American religion. I work on politics and media. That led me to an interest in how Eastern Orthodoxy developed in the United States. I did fieldwork with a far-right community in Appalachia for a year. I wrote a book about it. And now I'm a professor of religion and anthropology at Northeastern University.
Yes, and I'm a Catholic theologian. I have worked for quite a long time on, especially on Orthodoxy in Eastern Europe. So I came to this interest because I think probably it is one reason that I came from the GDR. So I have an Eastern German context and was learning Russian in school and such things. I went to Russia for 5 years and then came back and started my PhD and doing research on Russia, on Eastern Europe, on the post-Soviet space in a larger sense, and the role religion and Orthodoxy plays for these societies after the end of the Soviet Union.
Well, thank you both for being here. So we're, most of our audience is in the United States, and I think most Americans are probably broadly familiar with the idea of Protestant and Catholic and have some concept for what those styles of Christianity entail and maybe some of the points of tension between them. But Orthodoxy is not as big of a demographic force in the United States. It's a very big tradition globally, but in the U.S., it's fairly small. I think the estimates I've seen are roughly 1.5% of the U.S. population. So can you just give us a big picture, maybe 2 minutes, of what is Orthodox Christianity?
I think it's important to know that Orthodoxy is one of the four main branches we have in Christianity. So we have Catholics, you named them, Protestants. We also have the Oriental Orthodox, which is very ancient, and we have the Orthodox or Byzantine or Greek church family. So in church history, we had a split at the end of the first millennium in the Western branch and the Eastern branch. And this Eastern branch, broadly speaking, can be called the Byzantine or the Orthodox church family. Their main characteristics, I would say, are that they share one creed, the creed that they also share with Catholics and with Protestants broadly. They share also other ideas of teaching, of Christian teaching, but they have some special characteristics, like you all are aware, I think, of icon theology, of the special liturgy of a Byzantine, very festive, long liturgy, which is different from the Western tradition. We have at the moment, we have 15 independent churches in the world. They are different counts. They are organized as independent churches, but they understand themselves as one Orthodox church. But there are a lot of conflicts within this mix of independent churches.
It's also important to note that Eastern Orthodoxy specifically sees itself as the most ancient form of Christianity. It links itself directly to Jesus Christ. Like Catholicism, it is a liturgical type of Christianity. It has sacraments. It has the incense, so the smells and bells. It has prayer books and religious images or icons. Orthodoxy is interesting because of the way it develops in the political context of the Christian East. So it's particularly tied to empire, so the Byzantine Empire, the Russian Empire, and then it's tied to nations as well. So chances are, if you're in the United States and you look up Orthodox Church near me in Google Maps, you're going to see Russian, Serbian, Greek Orthodox. And because it's diasporic in the United States, it has developed differently over time than it has, say, in Russia or Ukraine. But even still, it's connected to this large body, as you noted, of like roughly 260 million Orthodox Christians globally.
So let's turn a little bit to the Orthodox Church in Russia now. Yeah. And I'm curious, when we think of the Soviet period operating under Soviet communism, we think of it as antagonistic towards religion, religious institutions, religious authority. Was that the case? How did the Orthodox Church fare under the Soviet Union? And how has it evolved since the fall of the Soviet Union?
For the Russian Orthodox Church, the most severe and most dangerous period were the 20s and the 30s before Second World War, because there was just an exceptional, I would say, repression and persecution of the Orthodox Church. And the church was almost extincted. So when the Second World War started, almost nothing of this church was left over. And the Second World War is a very important point, because during this time, the state under Stalin, who was one of the main enemies of the Orthodox Church until then, understood that he needs the church to win the war, very simply speaking. And he took the rest of this Orthodox Church, four bishops were left over. He took them and told them, look, let's make a deal. You will be somehow loyal to me and will work with us together, and we will be patriotic for your fatherland. And I will allow you a little part of freedom, of activities in our country. And this double dimension lasted all the time in the Soviet Union. You had a leadership which was compliant to the state, which collaborated, which was connected to the secret service, which was part of the repressive system and so on. And you had parishes which were persecuted under pressure, which had no freedom of religion at all. And when the church came out of this and the Soviet Union ended in the 90s, the situation was somehow maintained. There were no changes, no decommunization or something like that. People just remained in their places and continued to lead the church. And you nevertheless have this part of the Russian Orthodox Church, which was dissident, which was somehow part of the dissident movement, which tried to remain in distance to the political sphere.
I think there's no secret that the Russian Orthodox Church was persecuted under Soviet power, and particularly earlier in the 20th century. And many religious organizations were. The Orthodox Church had to, at some point, capitulate to state power in order to survive. And for people who left, so Russian Orthodox Christians who left Russia because of political and religious persecution in the early part of the 20th century, that capitulation to state power was really seen as a great scandal. And after that, it had to contend with how do we revitalize ourselves in a secular space? How to contend with other religious competitors in this new, like, shifting landscape? How to deal with a new type of governmental structure? And in 2019, when the Orthodox Church of Ukraine broke away from the Moscow Patriarchate, that was seen as a sort of massive assault on church unity that the Russian Orthodox Church was trying to build in the post-Soviet period. And when the Moscow Patriarchate realized that this was a problem, you saw a doubling down on unity language. And that unity was often part of their pitch of why they were partnering with the Russian government. And the government, particularly under Putin's leadership, his many different tenures in office, has had a deep interest in harnessing the power of religion to their advantage. And this relationship is quite public. You know, we've seen Putin use religious language and talking about sort of the destiny of where he sees the Russian imperial world going. We've seen Patriarch Kirill bless the war in Ukraine and say that Russian soldiers will have their sins immediately forgiven if they die in battle. So it is safe to say that in the post-Soviet context, church and state are really using each other to their own ends.
How big are we talking about when we talk about the Russian Orthodox Church? Like within Russia, how many, what percentage of people identify with the church or connected to the church? And what percentage participate in the church on any kind of ongoing basis?
Yeah, that's a very, very interesting statistics. We have numbers from Russia which tell us that there are always between 70 and 60% of the population who say they identify with Orthodoxy. That is mainly a cultural identification, because when we look at the numbers of practitioners, they are very, very low, and they went down during the last years. So we had always some numbers of, I think, from 5 to 10% going to church regularly, knowing some of the key faith teachings. And there were, I think, 1 or 2% of people of population visiting the church on Easter service. So this makes very, yeah, it's very illustrative, I guess, for the understanding of how Orthodox, what people understand in Russia when they say they are Orthodox. I think one part of the explanation for this statistical gap is that we had a huge renaissance in the 90s. So people after the end of the Soviet Union came in masses to the church, and there were not enough priests. So they were also overwhelmed with this interest in Orthodoxy, but they also had no opportunity to teach people, to make a proper catechesis. So people were not aware, they were not learned, they were not taught what it means to be Orthodox, just as it was just presented as the new idea of who Russians are. They are Orthodox. And this means that now we have a generation of people there which was never taught what Orthodoxy means, but is very very convinced that Orthodoxy is our identity when we say we are Russians.
It's very interesting that you have this sort of reactionary religious fervor after the end of the Soviet period in terms of people saying, I want to be baptized. There was this kind of revival of religiosity and revival of building up the church. So building church buildings, trying to get young men into seminary, trying to build up the ranks of clergy again. But at the same time, as Regina aptly points out, there was no sort of education of this new influx of faithful Orthodox Christians. And so what you have now, almost 30 years later, is people who are kind of unaware of, you know, the ins and outs of Orthodox life in a theological way. They understand it in a social way, they understand it in a cultural way, even a political way, but they don't understand it theologically.
You have both mentioned Patriarch Kirill a number of times, and for those who aren't familiar, can you say who Patriarch Kirill is? What's his background and what role does he serve now?
So Patriarch Kirill, Kirill Gundyaev is a cleric, is now the patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church. He became a priest in the 60s, and he was part of the external church's office. When the church was re-elevated by Joseph Stalin, they also founded this external church office, which was the main instrument for the Soviet politics to have international soft power politics. So the people from the church in this external church office were priests and bishops. They were allowed to go abroad in the Soviet times, where almost no one was allowed to go abroad. They had the task, of course, to bring in on the international sphere, to bring the Soviet propaganda. In 89, he became the head of this department and remained head of this department as a metropolitan until 2009, when he was elected Patriarch of Moscow, so the Patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church and whole Rus, how it is called. So his name implies already the leadership over the church in the whole territory of the ancient Rus, which is also, it's not only the Russian Federation, it's Ukraine, it's Belarus, it's Moldau, it's the Baltic states and Kazakhstan. So there is a huge territory deleted by different national borders within this Russian Orthodox Church, which he is the head of since 2009.
So obviously a big part of the reason we are having this conversation today is that there's here in towards the end of 2025, there's been this ongoing war between Russia and Ukraine, the invasion of Ukraine by Russia. And I think some folks in the United States, some folks around the world might recognize that there is a religious dimension to that. But
ostensibly you have two Orthodox churches that are representing these nations and are kind of undergirding these nations that are themselves kind of participating in this combat or this warfare, this the rhetoric of war. So help us understand the relationship between the Russian Orthodox Church and the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, and what is the tension between them, and how does that factor into this war, this ongoing war that we're witnessing?
So Ukraine and Russia are connected by their joint church history. If we look back in history, Christianity, Byzantine Christianity, came to this region via Kiev, so via Ukraine. Christianity started there with the famous baptism, 988, baptism of the Kievan prince Volodymyr. And then the history moved on, moved Christianity, and then later to Moscow in the 13th and 14th century. Since the 13th century, the secular leadership moved to Moscow and the church leadership moved to Moscow too. So the church in this territory became centered around Moscow. And this territory had Ukraine inside, had Belarus, but we know from the 20th century that a lot of nations of people in this region tried to get independence from the Russian influence in the 20th century. So we had in the Baltic states independence movements. After the empire, the Russian empire broke down, the beginning of the 20th century, a lot of independence movement appeared. And a lot of churches and or believers, Orthodox believers also had an understanding that they had to detach from Moscow. They had to gain independence together with their nations, with their countries. Moscow could not let go Ukraine for sure, because Ukraine is the center of its, or it's the baptismal font, as it is called, of the Russian statehood and of Russian church identity. So if you let go Ukraine, you will lose your identity, very shortly speaking. So there is a fight over this Christianity between Ukraine and Russia. We have had an independent church in Ukraine since the 90s, but this church was not acknowledged by any other Orthodox church in the world. And we had a branch of the Russian Orthodox Church of the Moscow Patriarchate in Ukraine called the Ukrainian Orthodox Church.
The other problem that happened was in 2018. You have the Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew of Constantinople blessing a council that meets in Kyiv, where they create a new Orthodox Church. Patriarch Bartholomew recognizes the Orthodox Church of Ukraine officially in 2019. So why does he do this? If the Russian Orthodox Church says that the Church of Ukraine is their origin story, why is he doing this? Because the Ecumenical Patriarch says that Ukraine was always the Church of Constantinople. This creates a theological and social rift between the Russian Orthodox Church and much of the rest of the Western Orthodox world. And that creates social tensions on the ground, both in Ukraine and Russia, and exacerbates the political situation that's already tenuous between Ukraine and Russia. I think it's safe to say that if they lose the churches in Ukraine, if they lose jurisdictional authority over them, they lose some of their cosmic historiography about the trajectory of Russia. Russia is seen as this, and Putin said this over and over, Russia is seen as this special territory, this God-given territory. And if you lose that origin story, you lose some of that significance for understanding how Russia can evolve in the modern world and how it can grow its boundaries. So you lose a lot if you lose that origin story.
So it sounds like there's this idea that the well-being of the nation and the well-being of the church are mutually aligned or mutually dependent on one another, or even collapsed entirely, one and the same. And there's a rupture during the communist period to a degree, but after the fall of the Soviet Union, this sort of comes aligned again in the imagination and the workings of both the church and the state. So this revitalization of the church can also lead to the restoration and the revitalization of the Great Russian Empire, the Great Russian state.
Yeah, and this is also connected to the idea of warfare, in fact, because this narrative works at the moment, so during the last 2 years, I would say, it works in the leadership of the church to justify Stalin or to re-embrace him as someone who did a lot of wrong and, of course, suppressed the church somehow. But he also found the right moment to bring the church back and to win the war. So Russia could, or the Soviet Union, Russia could defend the world from fascism because Stalin took the church back into legality. And this works now at the moment very strongly, that Russia has this task to save the world from everything bad, from Westernism, from liberalism, from Satanism, from fascism in Ukraine, because this was our task already in the 40s by winning the war against German fascism. So this is a very, very strong narrative at the moment, which mobilizes people, which brings people back where their grandfathers or grandgrandfathers fought this war for God or for God and fatherland and so on.
It occurs to me there's this really interesting phenomenon that during the communist era in the U.S., the U.S. is presenting Russia as godless and at least the U.S. as faithful. And now there seems to be something of a reversal that's happening, because I've heard these narratives coming from Putin and coming from Russia of the sort of godless secular West and the Russian Orthodox Church and Russia is trying to counter the secularism of the West. Can you say more about that? Is that right?
There is a flipping of the script. So, you know, during the Cold War, America is seen as salvific and holy and Russia is seen as this great red Satan, right? We're in what scholars would call the new Cold War period, which means there's an inversion of that model, right? So now we have the West portrayed as godless, as, you know, giving in to these sort of demonic, if we talk about spiritual warfare, giving in to these demonic ideas of liberalism and feminism. And Russia is now seen as this sort of moral entrepreneur that can advance a way of living that's traditional, that's nostalgic, that takes us back to the good old days. And so now we have people in the West who are conservative or far right looking at Russia saying, look, they have it so great. Vladimir Putin, with the help of his government, is enacting all of these legislative things against, you know, against gay marriage,
abortion.
Against abortion. Yes, that's a big one, right? Abortion. They're creating networks that, you know, are advancing homeschooling. They care about the family. We just had the year of the family in Russia. So they are pitching themselves actually quite well, if you think of it in PR terms, as the moral option on the global stage.
People talk a lot about Christian nationalism and kind of religious nationalism, right? Jewish nationalism, Islamic nationalism. How would you differentiate between a sort of religious nationalist impulse and a religious imperialist impulse?
So I read a lot about Christian nationalism in the United States, and I think a lot about religious imperialism broadly. And I like to think about Christian nationalism in the United States as sort of looking inward. It wants to control, it wants to securitize the borders. It wants to make America Christian again, as if that were a thing from its foundations, from its origin story. And I think about religious imperialism as a world-building project that expands. It doesn't care about national borders because those are a new innovation. Those are part of modernity. Rather, it's concerned with sort of this disposition it possesses from God as a sort of divine call in order to spread out not only religious ideas and values, but political authority and power, right? And so we see this, for example, in Putin's call to his compatriots abroad. So there's this idea that anyone who identifies as Russian and speaks the Russian language abroad is a compatriot. They can see themselves as a Russian citizen. He expands that idea. That was actually popularized by Yeltsin in the 90s. And he says, look, there's these loopholes for spiritual and cultural affinity as well. So what we see with Putin is actually a type of not just religious nationalism, but religious imperialism, in which he wants to expand the borders of Russia. And his Russian world project, his Ruski Mir project, which failed ultimately at first, is now sort of being revitalized as this vision for the world. And so things are pulled into this empire world building project, like morality, because it's useful, right? He sees that in the West, social moral values are a big issue. So he starts to play on that so he can expand his reach. So I like to think of it as two different things. One is securitizing inward and one is securitizing outward and expanding.
Yeah, I think that's very helpful. I mean, I sometimes say that religious nationalism is obsessed with borders and boundaries, both literal and symbolic. So like who belongs to the nation, who fits, but in that it is kind of accepting the borders of modern nation states and saying, kind of taking those as the premise. We are the United States of America, and therefore anyone here is an American. And now we're going to have a discourse about American Christianity and American Christian nationalism. It sounds like the religious imperialism is a more ancient impulse in some ways that comes before those borders and boundaries existed and wants to say, we don't accept even those borders and boundaries because we have this bigger, as you say, Sarah, a bigger world building project that is tapping into older narratives of identity and the relationship between religion and the state that wants to expand the modern borders of whatever the constricted kind of nation is and say, we actually own much more territory than what we were given in the kind of modern order.
Although we hear hints of it in Trump and his attempt to get Greenland and other places.
Well, and that's the thing is I think that I think there's a lot of religious imperialism
yes.
in the second Trump administration, even more than religious nationalism.
Sarah, I want to turn a little bit to the research that you've done linking Orthodox converts in the U.S. to some of the white supremacy movements in the U.S. and to MAGA. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Orthodox converts are one node in a constellation of reactionary religious groups that sort of make up the religious far right in the U.S. And even when within this node, as with most political groups, there are different types of affinity. So there are absolutely white supremacists, there are America First guys, MAGA folks. But many of these converts are really more concerned with anti-democratic, autocratic politics. So Putin, for example, is really an appealing figure for many of them. In my previous field work, I lived with a group of far-right converts to Orthodoxy in Appalachia, and many of them wanted Putin to become, speaking of empire, the next Russian czar. They wanted him to invade the United States. They wanted him to expand his political reach. So it's not so much about Trump for these folks as it is a different political project that can destabilize democracy.
I resonate with this image of the nodes of this kind of coalition on the Christian far right. I think that very much is what I observe happening in the Christian far right, is that you have a motley crew of different forms of Christian theology, different Christian traditions that all have their internal forms of political extremism and anti-democratic organizing that have coalesced around Trump and MAGA, often for quite different reasons and different motivations that bring them there, but with a shared project of building a Christian nation, again, conceived of very differently among them, and of displacing democracy so that these more monarchic, imperialistic, nationalistic styles of governance can take over. And where do the Orthodox kind of influencers fit in that constellation of MAGA and far right influencers?
So it depends. Again, they have often different ideological value sets, but they're particularly interested in deepening their connections with Russian conservative contacts. You know, so much so that you have, you know, some young upstart from Texas who is friends with Alexander Dugin on social media, DMs him, and then all of a sudden is at a summit in Moscow speaking. So these connections are made in the virtual world, but have real world implications for connecting these guys. So I think, you know, we have this, again, the Motley Crue reference is perfect here, because we have this unique system in the United States in which the far right is sort of this umbrella term for all of these anti-democratic groups. We don't want to call them anti-democratic right away. We want to use a softer term, so we say far right. But that's really what they are. The folks I look at are really about creating a new empire, right? They want to be sort of subsumed into this Russian imperial imaginary that they hope will spread across the globe. And they hope that it will convert people to orthodoxy along the way, right? And so, yes, they will partner with these sort of more traditional Christian nationalist, evangelicals, dominionist, etc. But they really see their project as, you know, the exceptional one, the one that is the goal.
Yeah, so in some ways, when we start kind of flipping the script between religious nationalism and religious imperialism, and then we start to think about the kind of global picture, that it's less that these folks are missionaries of MAGA to a Russian audience, and more that they are missionaries of Putin and the Russian Orthodox Church to an American Christian audience. Is exactly. that a fair way to put it?
Yeah, that's the perfect way to put it.
Just for clarification, what's drawing folks to these movements and to the Orthodox Church and to the sort of larger religious imperialist movement? Is it issues predominantly of race, of gender, of theological ideas?
I think they grab a hold of all of those threads. They really want a traditional religious experience, and they see the Russian Orthodox Church outside of Russia as this crystallized version of Russian Orthodoxy that has been untouched. It's unspoiled by modernity. And that really appeals to them in terms of historical Christianity. But it's also patriarchal and hierarchical, so that appeals to largely the men who are converting. It's very structured and rigid, so the hours of standing in church, the lengthy fast during the liturgical cycle, all of that appeals to this idea of being masculine and being a soldier for Christ. There's these normative Western gender roles that they associated with it. So women aren't priests. Women really don't have a role in the church, according to these guys, beyond singing in the choir and maybe feeding them after church. So that appeals to this sort of gender complementarianism that they practice. And also they see this idea of monarchy or imperialism as the correct form of political power.
And within these different kind of constellation of the far right, we have these like pithy phrases that we throw out to kind of characterize large groups of these folks. So there's the New Apostolic Reformation, there's the Reformed Theobros, the Rad Trad Catholics. Is there a pithy word for these kind of more Orthodox inspired influencers and leaders? And can you give us some examples of people that maybe some in our audience have kind of come across online, or so who are some of the kind of major players in the Orthodox far right in America?
So they like to self-style themselves as ortho bros. They're following the Theo bros. I like to term them reactive Orthodox because they are reacting to what they perceive of as the ills of modernity. So there's a wide variety, and there's smaller niche content creators who are neo-Confederates, who are trad wives, who let's not forget the women in this. There are also women content creators. Sometimes I think when we talk about far-right content creators online, we tend to talk only about men, but there are definitely women in this movement as well who position themselves as sort of bastions of femininity, but are also, very active in the debate culture.
Donald Trump has a very strange relationship with Vladimir Putin, and we aren't going to get into all the complexities and idiosyncrasies of that, but what role does this affinity between Trump and Putin play within these kind of transnational religious coalitions and movements? How do they interpret and perceive and participate in that affinity?
It's this idea or this ideal of masculinity and hierarchy, which brings in a certain kind of personality in political power. So what they present, what they represent is appealing, and people somehow, some people feel that this is the right way to do politics and international relations and so on. From my research, I see that one of the main connecting topics between Russia and the US and the Russian Orthodox Church and the evangelical groups in the US, or there are probably two topics. There is this anti-democratic, anti-liberalism, where gender is one of the key topics. But the other topic, which is important also for the war, is religious freedom. And they are doing politics over this religious freedom agenda and appropriating religious freedom and the persecuted Christian narrative. because we, of course, have Christian persecuted Christians all over the world. But this is not what they are really interested in. They are interested in their agenda in showing that Christians are persecuted by liberal values. They are not so much interested in the Christians somehow in the Middle East or in Africa being persecuted. But they play very much on this agenda. And the US wants to save the world in this regard. And Russia wants to save the world in this regard.
I just have to observe the completely bizarre situation that you would have an American president who came up in reality television partnering with a Russian KGB agent to protect religious freedom around the world by spreading their versions of imperialism.
Yes,
this is the moment we're in the 21st century.
That's where we are, right? Yeah.
I'm curious about the efforts that are underway in Russia and the former Soviet Union to try to push back against some of these forms of creeping authoritarianism, the religious imperialism, the collusion between political and religious leaders in ways that have had anti-democratic consequences. What have some of those resistance strategies looked like? What has been effective? What hasn't been effective?
I mean, if we were looking at the past few years, the resistance space is so small in terms of reacting against either the Russian government or the Russian Orthodox Church. Among the clergy, you had like 17 priests and deacons defrocked since 2022. You had, I think it was roughly 14 priests suspended from ministry. Some were forced into retirement for their anti-war stances. So the state surveillance is in full swing, and they're even using parishioners to inform on each other, to inform on clergy.
I think when we talk about resistance, the first thing we have to talk about is that Russia, so I'm used to talk about Russia during the last 2 years as a totalitarian state. And everything which we talk about resistance has to be talked about with this lens, because totalitarianism means that there is literally no space for resistance. So there is, of course, something going on, but it's very silent, it's very invisible, and you really have to carefully look it up, because you will bring danger to the people who are doing this resistance in this system with every time you will publicly somewhere something show up. So this is important, because I see that people tend to underestimate the scale of repression which has been going on in Russia during the last years. Pussy Riot has been a crucial moment for the Russian society in showing that resistance is possible and at the same time closing this window of opportunity. This was 2012. Pussy Riot was in 2012 in February. It was after long months of broad protests. So in Russian scale, it was really a huge protest going on, the so-called Bolotnaya protests and other protests after election fraud by Putin and so on. So there was a long story of protest and the state trying to bring this protest down. The Russian Orthodox Church would never be part or somehow align itself with protest, with anti-governmental protest. I think there are few Orthodox churches which would ever do protest against their own state, because this is something theologically rather unimaginable that you will protest in such a way. So the church was more part of the state politics against this protest. And Pussy Riot, of course, were the main point in history where women as a feminist protest stepped out publicly to criticize also the coalition between church and state, the sacralization of the state by the church, and to criticize that the church lost its ability to criticize the state at all, so lost its distance, lost its prophetic voice. And this prayer, it was framed as a prayer, was meant to show that the church has to raise its prophetic voice in a church and not to just commit or comply to what the state is telling them. And the effect of Pussy Riot was that Putin and the church very well understood that this could be a threat for them in every regard, and they did everything to cut these kind of resistance down. So after that, we saw a huge amount of laws prohibiting every kind of public activity of civil society actors and so on, with every year more. So since 2012 until 2022, there is an absolute restriction, shrinking spaces for civil society for doing something in resistance or in protest of what the state and the church are doing. And nevertheless, of course, it's interesting to see as a legacy of Pussy Riot that one of the most effective and still visible kinds of resistance to this regime and to this church is feminist protest. So one of the very few niches where you can see in the internet, it's mostly it's Instagram, it's a little bit of other social media, but mostly it's Instagram, is feminist protest. So it's very small scale activities, flyers, stickers somewhere, some graffiti or something like this, some murals at some point, which are never with some faces, so you will never see the people behind them. They do it anonymously, but they are trying to get some public international audience for that there is something else in Russia than the Russian regime and the church regimes.
Regina, I want to ask you about this figure, Alexei Navalny, who was an opposition leader, even ran against Putin in some elections, but then was poisoned and ultimately died in prison in 2024. How did Navalny code within this kind of church-state alliance? How was he seen as a kind of religious figure?
So we saw a moment of connection with Navalny, and it was very interesting because I had the feeling that the secular part of the opposition movement, of the Russian opposition movement, was so happy to have some religious kind of person being like a savior-like personality in this context. So there is so much despair and so much pessimism about everything connected to Russia that even the most secular opposition politicians or activists turned to Navalny as a religious person, as someone who could bring them hope. And this was very interesting because I think in Navalny there is not so much churchy things, but nevertheless to see just this impulse how people are in despair to look for a person who could somehow make everything good again or bring some hope in the situation was very interesting. But for the church, the problem is that we would need a theological endeavor of all Orthodox churches to come to terms with this ideas of political orthodoxy, of nationalism, of philatism, of these imperialistic ideas. So there has to be a reassessment of Orthodox theology, and this has to go on in community of this church. But we have no community in the Orthodox Church at the moment. We have the split Sarah talked about. So it is really difficult to get a new paradigm in a theological way about thinking politics, thinking the state, thinking society, getting a relation to civil society and not just to the state, for example. This is really a hard work we have to do and which is not even underway. So I would clearly say that, and it's fair to say that he was murdered. So this is something I think it is important to underline because almost no one from the opposition in Russia just dies. It's always somehow done. For Navalny, this counts, of course, very much more because he was very seriously poisoned 2 years before he was then killed in prison. And it was part, of course, of the Russian strategy to delete somehow the opposition at this point. But this is important for the religious framing because there was immediately the term of martyr in the room when he was killed. So that is someone who died for his idea of a better Russia and of a better living together in Russia and of resisting. He died because he resisted the anti-Christian regime which Putin built up. So this was some framing which was going on. Navalny himself became a religious person in his time in prison. So we have evidence or we have witnesses that before this very difficult time in his life after the poisoning, he was maybe one of the typical Russian Orthodox persons. So he, of course, would always say that Orthodoxy is important for Russia and that he is somehow Orthodox, but he was not the person who would quote the Bible in some political speeches. And this was something which evolved during his prison time in Russia, where he wrote letters, where he came with information or with witnesses from the prison framed as a religious experience or as something which opened his eyes for the religious dimension of life. And this was taken up afterwards very much for people who were looking for some kind of guidance or hope in this hopeless situation.
Regina, I know you study feminist resistance in Russia. So I'm curious how that resistance interfaces with or coordinates with other feminist movements around the world. Are there ways that feminist organizations can do more to support women in Russia and Ukraine?
This is a really difficult topic because the relationship between post-Soviet feminists, not only in Russia, but also in Ukraine, for example, or in Belarus, with the Western feminists is complicated. And this is due to the story of Soviet feminism, which has a lot of different ideas or is just a different kind of feminism. There would be a lot to talk about at this point, but I think it's not the time to do so. But what is important or what comes out of this situation is that the feminists in Russia and in Ukraine, I have seen them as very disappointed by the Western feminism and their solidarity or not solidarity with what they are going through. Of course, there has been solidarity letters or the kind of support which feminist organizations from the West try to give to Russia and also to Ukraine. And I took it together because it's some kind similar, this situation. But the Russian and the Ukrainian feminists always felt like this kind of colonizing gaze of the Western feminist movement to what they really experience in the Soviet system or in the post-Soviet system, and they try to distance themselves and have their own agenda. And there has been efforts to make a transnational network of feminist organizations, but of civil society movements at all, also in general. It was very much financed by Western organizations, and the Russian state did a lot to cut all connections between Western and Russian organizations, civil society organizations, civil society structures, so that most of them in Russia had to quit their work during the last years and because of the lack of finances and support. The situation is very complicated for people who want to support Russian organizations or Russian civil society movements or resistance movements, because you always bring your partners in danger. It's like they not just claimed that these organizations are bad and have to be deleted, but they also claimed organizations in Germany, for example, as foreign agents and as extremists. So I am part of two organizations which are claimed extremist in Russia. And that means that I bring danger to my partners and my colleagues in Russia when I try to support them in some way. And this makes it really difficult. So they are very isolated and unseen. So there would be, of course, an opportunity for Western feminists to bring them more visibility and to somehow bring attention to that there is going on some resistance in Russia. But they are so invisible that I have the impression that Western feminists are not very keen to look for them and to bring them really into attention.
Sarah, you're sort of uniquely positioned in this conversation as being from the U.S. and based in the U.S. and thinking about these dynamics within Russia, but then also living and experiencing these dynamics in the U.S. of Christian nationalism and its connections to some of the assaults against democracy. So I wonder if you can make some of those connections for us based on your experience, and specifically with this question of holding the challenges to resistance and what kind of resistance can happen within a totalitarian regime in Russia. But what do you see as possibly some of the lessons from this long experience of resisting this in Russia to what's possible here in the U.S.?
I think that if we look at what is happening in the United States, we see that we are headed towards a cliff in terms of democracy. And at the bottom of that cliff is the sea of totalitarianism. And I think that activists, feminists, scholars who have been vocal in their opposition against Putin's totalitarian regime have been waving, their flags. They have been holding up the signs that say, stop, listen to us. And as a sort of herd of bison, we just keep going. I think what we have to see is that democracy is fragile. It always has been. And, you know, this Trump administration has shown us that it can easily start to fall apart if we don't use our voices and our votes and our feet to mobilize. Now, whether the United States will end up in a similar situation to Russia, probably a lot of far-right guys would be really happy about that. But what we will end up seeing is the suppression of people who have long been suppressed already, disabled people, women, minorities, as we see in Russia right now. So I think the lessons that these bold and brave activists offer us is that we have to resist whatever we see types of nationalism that are combined with religiosity, whenever we see religious leaders talking about a grand imperial vision, and whenever we see politicians using religion to try to sway the populace, we have to resist.
It's a good word for the end. Thank you, Sarah.
This isn't just a game. It's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
That was a really sobering interview. Like Myanmar, we have here a warning case in the example of Russia, an illustration of how hard it is to retrieve democracy once a state has been captured. You know, after the 2024 election, Susie, I was asked to give some presentations about the agenda of the incoming administration and where things could go under Trump. And instead of playing the prophet and saying, I have seen our future and let me predict it, I usually just tried to go with what we're doing on this show, explain some of the parallel cases where we've seen religious nationalism paired with a wannabe authoritarian leader, and what happens when those groups try to overpower and cripple a democracy. And I would walk people through the recent cases of Poland and Turkey and India. But even in those presentations, the worst case scenario I could come up with for what the U.S. could be on the trajectory of becoming was modern day Russia. I'll say this. I think 10 more years of the type of governance we've seen in the United States in 2025 could get us there. Let me try to describe what the experience of Russian autocracy to you. It's blindly imperialist, sacrificing hundreds of thousands of Russian lives for a war that is only stoking Putin's vanity. I mean, it's just about him and his ego. The country is authoritarian to the nth degree, repressing what people can say and do. The whole system is wedded to this church hierarchy of cynical leaders who reinforce this dictator's tyrannical messages with their own theological justifications. It is unbelievably corrupt. Russian oligarchs are these legendary businessmen slash mob bosses who steal and swindle and extort every penny they can from the Russian people and enforce their will with violence. And this Russian autocracy claims to be a democracy, holding sham elections that somehow, mysteriously, only Vladimir Putin and his approved candidates can ever win, because maybe if you try to run against them, you'll end up dead. Now, that is not the situation we are in the U.S., but doesn't that sound like the full-grown version of what Trump has been incubating in his first year of his second term? I am truly grateful for those in Russia who do resist against this incredible oppression. I'm grateful that they are raising alarm bells for us here, at least to those of us with whom they have relationships, people like Sarah Riccardi Swartz. And they're telling her, we need to wake up and get activated before it's too late. They would know. It must be chilling to watch what has happened to you happen to others in another part of the world and not be able to stop it.
Yeah, like watching a car wreck and you know exactly how this story ends.
Yeah.
And we know that Trump has this admiration for Putin. He seems to put him on a pedestal, at least with regard to his performance of masculinity, his dominance and his commanding hold on power. Trump envies that. He admires that. I wouldn't be surprised if he has one of those weird photos of a shirtless Putin sitting on his bedside table. And there's clear ways in which it seems like Trump and those around him are following the exact same authoritarian playbook Putin has used for decades. Demonizing and outlawing political opposition, labeling activists terrorists or extremists, corrupting elections, capturing the media. I mean, look around today in the U.S. How many of our major news outlets are now owned by billionaires in Trump's orbit? Is it all of them? They're creating a political patronage system for the wealthy, a sort of pay-to-play type system, and scapegoating vulnerable communities along the way, and on and on. It's all so familiar. It's like Trump's just leaning over and copying the answers right off Putin's exam.
Yeah, there's a reason that Trump and Putin get along so well. They see the world in much the same way, as other people are there to be exploited and taken advantage of for their purposes. I do really want to draw out this important distinction that Sarah made between religious nationalism and religious imperialism, because they're different impulses. They can sometimes work together. They're not entirely mutually exclusive, but it's important to distinguish them. And as Sarah was saying, nationalisms are generally about policing borders and boundaries. And so often it gets tied in then with nativism and racism and hatred of groups of people who don't quote unquote belong.
It's the blood and soil argument.
Yes. Yeah. And it's always the religious nationalists who get to define belonging in this case. But nationalism shores up those borders and boundaries and works on defining who the in-group is. Nationalism is about claiming, right? This is our blood and soil. Well, imperialism is about claiming other people's blood and soil. Imperialism is about expansion and wars of aggression. Imperialism is about asserting your country's will upon the world. So religious nationalism tends to be more of this God and country, God bless the USA, white Christians are the real Americans kind of argument, right? It's internally focused. But religious imperialism is about conquering the world in the name of your religion or your nation or your empire. And for those who are familiar with my work on the New Apostolic Reformation, I'd say that is more of a Christian imperialist or Christian supremacist movement. They hang out with the Christian nationalists, and sometimes they'll even say the same slogans about America. But they see this nation, they see the U.S. as just one stepping stone to conquering the whole planet. And I would say that in his first term, I think Donald Trump was much more of a religious nationalist in his language, when he dabbled in theology, and even in his policymaking. There was a lot more of the, like, fear the immigrant, the black, and the Jew rhetoric, and more hugging of flags, sometimes quite ostentatiously. His first term was really about shoring up this definition of Americanness as white, Christian, straight, and more often than not, rich. But in his second term, Trump has started veering into more religious imperialist terminology. He jokes about taking over Greenland or the Panama Canal. He's, as we record this, threatening war with Venezuela. And who knows, maybe by the time this airs, those threats will become even more of a reality. Again, nationalism and imperialism, they can work together and they can reinforce each other. But imperialist rhetoric is taking nationalism up to another level. Imperialists, almost by definition, make war to gain new territory. And there's a massive Christian imperialist propaganda campaign going on underneath that Trumpian imperialist posturing. And that propaganda campaign, led by people like the New Apostolic Reformation, claims that Donald Trump is a specially anointed, even quasi-messianic leader sent to save America. It uses the Butler, Pennsylvania assassination attempt and Trump's remarkable good luck as proof that God's hand is upon him, and it sanctifies anything that he wants to do. But if we bring it back to Russia, Putin also has this religious imperialist propaganda machine undergirding his Russian imperialistic action in Ukraine. I mean, it looks different than what we have in the U.S., because in the U.S., this religious propaganda is all being distributed through these diffused media networks and influencers on the religious right. And in Russia, that propaganda network is concentrated in the upper echelon leadership of the Russian Orthodox Church.
Yeah, that's all really helpful. And it's also just really interesting to think about how we have these two competing dimensions to religious nationalism in the U.S. We have that nationalist bent that is very focused on policing borders and on whiteness. And we have that imperialist bent. And we've had it throughout U.S. history, right?
Yes.
This is not a new phenomenon, but that tension and those dynamics have played out in different parts of American history. So this is just a new iteration of it that we're going through right now.
Yeah, and maybe we'll draw this out more in our last episode. But in the U.S., we can maybe distinguish between these types of nationalism and imperialism. A lot of the forms of religious nationalism we've looked at is more resisting colonialism, resisting mm-hmm. colonization and imperialism. And we have that in early America. The colonists were using religious language to resist the British imperialism. But then the U.S. also became an imperial power.
Yes.
And so we colonized other people and used religious language to do so. And so we have these kind of distension, this dueling kind of impulse within us that I think makes American Christian nationalism especially complicated.
And I would argue even at the beginning, we were colonizing the U.S., right? Turtle
Good
Island.
Point. Yes.
And Manifest
yes.
Destiny and so
yep.
on. And then
yep.
it went outside the borders of
yep.
Turtle Island.
All there.
It's fascinating to me as well, this fact of fairly low levels of religious participation in Russia, at least in institutional church life. It helps explain to me the church's sense of vulnerability and its power calculations to saddle up to Putin and the state in this alliance in order to shore up the power of the church, given its lack of people participation within it. But in some ways, I think it also helps explain to me why the church gets away with this alliance with Putin. I can say as a clergy person that you can only get so far ahead of your lay members, no matter how hierarchical your church structure is. And also, I know, as I've said before, research shows that it's easier for folks to become religiously radicalized when their grasp of doctrine, history, teachings is weak. The more religious education folks have, the less likely they are to be radicalized. And of course, in Russia and in the former Soviet Union, you have a place where religion was suppressed for a long time. And so understandably, religious education, religious literacy is low as the church has sought to reestablish itself among the general population. Of course, there's also this deep irony that Russia is calling the West godless, when in fact religiosity rates among both the right and the left are higher, at least here in the U.S. and also, I believe, in Ukraine.
Yeah, and this is one of those great lessons from the U.S. founding fathers. The blending of church and state isn't just bad for the state. It's bad for the church, right? The churches that are captured by imperial interests or by state powers tend to do worse just on basic facts of demographics in terms of how they appeal to people because they are wedded to this imperial power. I do want to make a quick note that there's this whole mythology, and Sarah Riccardi-Swartz is really the expert to talk to about this. I mean, she has done this fascinating field research on it, but there's this whole mythology on the religious right in the U.S., that Russia is this Christian paradise, this godly, model, moral nation built on Christian principles, and that Putin is this deeply Christian leader and really this paragon that we should all try to attempt to follow. And it's been part of what's fueling this phenomenon of conversions to Eastern Orthodoxy among far-right youth in America. You have the people who are joining the Eastern Orthodox tradition because they want to cozy up to Putin and they want to adopt this model. Now, remember, Eastern Orthodoxy is relatively small in the U.S. So maybe about 1% of the U.S. population identifies as Eastern Orthodox. So this phenomenon that is happening is happening in a pretty small corner of American Christianity. That's much smaller in its reach or influence as compared with, say, what's happening with the radicalization of evangelical Christians or with far-right Catholics. But I will say this, among the influencer class on the far right, these ortho bros, which apparently is what they want to be called now, they punch way above their weight. They have more influence than you would expect.
And of course, they're influencing both the religious realm in the U.S. and the political realm, because they are also pushing for certain foreign policy priorities that favor Russia. Okay, so let's turn to lessons from the resistance. I've learned a lot from Regina about the feminist networks across Europe that have supported women activists in Russia. It's a critical source of solidarity, and it's a conduit of information about what's happening in Russia. We've talked about how these pluralist fascist coalitions around the world often rally around issues related to gender and sexuality. And so it makes perfect sense to me that the transnational coalitions of resistance might begin or be led by women and queer folks who are so deeply and primarily impacted by these policies. The women of Poland might be facing a different form of religious nationalism, different political dynamics vis-a-vis NATO and the Ukraine-Russia war, but they are definitely facing similar repressive gender laws and narratives to the women in Russia, just as are the women in India and those of us here in the U.S. and in Korea.
And it's so important, this kind of binding together of these various communities that we've been talking about, right? These building these kind of transnational networks of learning and sharing. And Sarah also mentioned the Russians who are in diaspora. The diaspora becomes a really important location for sharing information, but also forging these solidarity networks across these national borders. We saw this throughout our series, really. I mean, think about David Mo, our expert on Myanmar. He's supporting the resistance movement in Myanmar while being a diaspora scholar here in the U.S. And even in that same episode, Geetika Dharmasinghe is also a Sri Lankan scholar who's been teaching in Canada, sharing her knowledge and insights with us here in North America. João Chaves and Raimundo Barreto are both Brazilian scholars with deep family and network ties to Brazil who are helping to further the resistance to religious authoritarianism back home. Aisha Kadifikichi Oriana, she's a Turkish scholar here in the U.S. helping support women's rights and freedom in Turkey. Ray Kim and Helen Jin Kim are both Korean-American scholars who have these transnational ties. Nikhil Mandalaparthi and Anant Ramachan, diaspora Indian-American scholars who are also activists against Hindu nationalism here and abroad. Atalia Omer, Israeli scholar. Ben Lorber, American Jew. But they're both working against the worst edges of Zionism, both Jewish and Christian. I mean, the backbone of this series has been scholars and activists, because there's actually a lot of overlap between those two categories, right? There are many scholar activists and activist scholars who, from their various diasporas, are sharing their knowledge with us. This is how we do it. This is how we build these transnational channels of learning and sharing ideas. And of course, we also have Russians in diaspora here in the U.S. whose voices we can be amplifying, but also with whom we can be getting this kind of critical advice and conversation. These are people who know what might be coming next, and they can give us insight and wisdom into how to prevent it.
Yes. As we talk about the importance of transnational solidarity networks to share tactics and disrupt the authoritarian alliances, we have an enormous opportunity here in the U.S. We have folks from around the world living in this country, perhaps more so than any other place in the world. Certainly representation from all the countries we've discussed in this podcast. Folks who can share all those lessons and help us connect with those elsewhere. So we have to take advantage of this incredible opportunity that we have in the U.S. as Americans.
And most importantly, as we conclude, let's learn from Pussy Riot. I mean, they are truly amazing. I know a lot of people aren't really into punk music, so their aesthetic might not always be your cup of tea. I'll be honest, I'm not much of a punk person myself. I don't know if you know that about
me. You're missing out, man.
But if you look past this like punk aesthetic, they are religious activists against Russian Orthodox collusion with Putin. They are standing up against the religious nationalism and religious imperialism that keeps a tyrannical goon like Putin in such a prominent place of power. They are doing the work of resisting within their country and their space, and they're also teaching us great lessons here.
And they stand on the shoulders of a long history of Christian and Jewish prophetic tradition in doing so.
Yes.
The Jeremiahs, the Isaiahs, these figures who use similarly provocative public acts in order to draw attention to the violence of the powerful. So yes, yes, yes to Pussy Riot from their fearlessness, their creativity, their claim to that prophetic tradition in the face of a Putin-appeasing church hierarchy. On December 15th, a court in Moscow is scheduled to decide whether to label the group an extremist organization. I think that means that by the time y'all are listening to this, you'll know the outcome. We don't know now, so you are in the future, you know. But whatever it is, I trust that it's not going to stop them. This group that is by design an amorphous collection of activists, it's just going to make them more punk. They had an awesome post on social media on November 28th in which they responded to the charge, and I just want to quote them here. They said, "Singing in the streets is not extremism. doing street actions is not extremism. Extremism is invading other countries and committing war crimes. Being anti-fascist and wearing a Pikachu costume is not extremism. Pussy Riot have always stood and will continue to stand with Saint Nikolai, who wasn't afraid to throw a piece of raw meat at the feet of Ivan the Terrible himself, calling him out, "You eat human flesh and blood." And if telling the truth is extreme, then hold my Red Bull. May the Mother of God bless you, sisters. We're with you in the struggle. That's it for this episode of American Unexceptionalism. Thanks for joining us.
Please hit subscribe and give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts.
You can keep up with this show and all the other great series from Axis Mundi Media at www.axismundi.us.
This show is produced by Andrew Gill and engineered by Scott Okamoto. Funding provided by the Institute for Islamic, Christian, and Jewish Studies, Princeton Theological Seminary, and the International Center on Religion and Diplomacy.
Until next time, remember, the struggle for democracy is global, and we aren't alone.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.